Welcome, ladies, gentlemen, slaves of the global plantation! The Vinnie Eastwood Show is bad news. It's like the news, but worse. It's the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't enjoy it. Otherwise, what's the point of being killed? The Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're the only thing worse than living in a high-tech global police state run by child trafficking Satanists. It's Vinnie's jokes. I mean, seriously, they're just awful. My very special guest is Vicky Joy Anderson, the author, researcher, and poet from Vicky Joy Anderson .com, and this is what we're doing now. So thank you so much for appearing with us, and I'm just going to get some of the text and everything rearranged on the screen. But you know, as they say in Israel, without further ado, could you just tell us a little bit about who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Vicky Joy Anderson, and I am a writer, researcher, poet, as you just said. And you know, I kind of found my niche in the last 5 years. You know, I kind of always thought I was just going to write pleasant, beautiful little things that titillated everyone's senses, and poetry and all that kind of stuff. And I guess I thought we were living in a world where everything was beautiful and perfect. And when I found out differently, it just put me down an entire different stream of writing. And so I write a lot of stuff on fringe topics and a lot of controversial things, a lot of triggering things that people on both sides of the aisle don't really like to agree with. So I'm writing on sleep paralysis. This particular book is on sleep paralysis. It's something that I have experienced for over 40 years, and come to find out, so have thousands and thousands of other people. This is just part of the grand agenda for mind control.
So let's sort of talk about that as well. I mean, how'd you get into doing all of this? Because you said you found out the world wasn't all sunshine and rainbows and sugar-coated cupcakes, as it were. What kind of a rude awakening did you get?
Oh, well, I have YouTube to thank for that. I was just minding my own business one night, binge-watching Pawn Stars, thinking that all was good. And some suggested Just For You videos showed up on my column. And the reason I noticed it is because usually the videos that are suggested for you are based upon previous searches. And so they know that, you know, these are the things that she's interested in. And these videos had nothing to do with anything I had ever searched out before or even ever heard of. And so because they kept showing up, I was intrigued. And so I started watching these videos. I think the first one was on all of like the satanic symbology in pop music and all of these musicians that I had grown up listening to and loving. Come to find out, they were all sort of flashing these signs and hand signals and things. And so that took me down a massive, massive rabbit hole about just, oh, all the classic conspiracies that you're not even allowed to talk about anymore without getting in trouble. You know, all the, you know, from innocent things from like the Paul is dead conspiracies and JFK stuff to Sandy Hook to 9/11, and just the all of the cover-ups and deep state stuff going on in the United States. And then that brought me into the realms of more of like the biblical stuff with Tom Horn, L.A. Marzulli, Chuck Missler, the things talking about the Nephilim and the ancient aliens and the Anunnaki and the Book of Enoch and all of these things. And so my brain has been pummeled to death over the last probably 5 to 8 years as my mind has just been blown, just opening my mind to these things, that the world is just not what we always thought that it was. And especially here in America, where everything is, you know, up until 2019, everything was just rosy and apple pie, and everybody was rich and happy and fat and stupid and being entertained to death, and everything was great. And I'm just glad I had my rude awakening before 2020, because God only knows what would have happened to my poor little brain if I had entered into 2020 unprepared.
Yeah, I found that very similar myself, is that a lot of people, when the lockdown started happening, were freaking out. Oh my God, how could government do this? Why would they do this? And I'm like the only person who's sitting around going, really? You didn't see this coming, you know?
You're surprised.
Right, you know, I'm jaded and cynical. A journalist should be. And that's how it works. And so when you see stuff like this, it happens, it's new stuff, different day. Like, and I notice on your website here, you've got The Emperor's New Gender. Is that a book claiming that the emperor wears no dick?
Well, now no one has to read it. Spoiler alert.
That's a spoiler alert.
Oh, man. Yeah, you know, that classic Hans Christian Andersen tale, you know, the emperor's naked, everybody knows it, no one wants to speak up. And I thought, what a perfect tale for our generation. And there's all this stuff going on right in front of our faces. The politicians are naked, the pastors are naked, the churches are naked, everything is naked. This woke culture is steamrolling down our streets. It's a Trojan horse that's been brought into every sanctuary, every school, every home, every TV room. And the church, who is supposed to stop these immoral things, are just kind of sitting back and just, you know, it's not even that they're trying to like block the doors from it coming in. Now they're like getting out their hacksaws and like widening the doors to accommodate the size of the Trojan horses rolling in. And I just thought, at what point is that little boy in the crowd going to say, hey, like, wait a minute, the guy's naked. Like, who's going to say it? The guy's naked? Who's going to say it? And of course, you know, there's people that try to say it and they just get silenced and they get canceled and, you know, all that stuff. But I think that if more people were saying, you know, the guy's naked, right? Like if millions of people were saying that, then maybe we could turn the train around. But I think I'm being far too optimistic at this point to think that the train's going to turn around. But I do wish more people would be able to say out loud, you know, hey, the guy's naked. He's not wearing anything.
Yeah, that chick has no dick. It's the obvious thing, and it's usually it takes a child as well, because in the story the emperor has no clothes. It was in fact a child who said, yes. No, the emperor is naked. You know, everybody else is like, no, he's just wearing invisible clothes. And it's like, no, he's not. He got scammed. He's naked, bro. Like, bro, come on. This is the situation where we try to find ourselves in now, where ostensibly the wisdom of a child. It seems to eclipse the so-called practiced wisdom of adults now, because a child can see things very, very obviously for what they are, because they don't really have that kind of belief structure or brainwashing ingrained in them, and that submission to authority. They haven't learned that yet, as it were. And now, though, this world, oh boy.
Yeah, they're doing their best to break that part of the child's innocence too. I mean, the education system here in America, these children are being taught, you know, what's up is down and what's left is right. And so even that innate part of a child that used to question things, they're now being taught to question from the opposite angle. And so they're not questioning, hey, how come the emperor's naked? They're questioning, how come you think the emperor's naked? Who told you the emperor's naked? You know, and I don't know. It just has so many connotations, you know.
I'm offended that you think the emperor's naked.
Exactly. How dare you not think that flesh suit was designed by Michael Kors?
Well, how come everybody else is wearing clothes?
Yeah. That's true. But see, that the guy without clothes is courageous. He deserves a courage award. That's why he's not wearing clothes.
I mean, we're just basically drowning in a frickin' sea of mental illness as far as I'm concerned. You know, people are just like completely out of touch with reality. And then they somehow got their hands on the media, which tells everybody what reality is. And now they made everybody as out of touch with reality as they are.
Yeah. Unbelievable the psychological operation that this television has done for us. I cannot believe how much power it has taken on. And it's very interesting if you go into the origins of the invention of the television tubes and things like that, and what they were really initially trying to accomplish with that invention, all sorts of like the things that I talked, it was like designed to be some sort of a tool to communicate with other dimensional planes and other dimensional beings, and gets into the whole entire if you go deep down the rabbit hole with like studying what some of the Nazi programs were, and with the reverse engineering and various things that they were attempting to do by bringing in ancient knowledge, this kind of stuff, going all the way back to, it mentions it in the Book of Enoch and Genesis 6, where these watchers or these Anunnaki or these titans, whatever you want to call them, came down and spilled heavenly secrets to man, and man was in great pursuit of these things, as they still are today.
Now, Vicky, we're having just a little bit of trouble with your webcam there. Would you be able to just quickly turn it off and on again?
I shall do that.
Sorry about this, folks. We have some plaguing technical difficulties today, but there we go. It's cranking. All right, sorry. The Anunnaki, go ahead. Awesome.
Yeah, so, the Book of Enoch, it's great, really interesting read. And, in religious circles, there's big arguments over whether or not it's the divine-inspired word of God or not, or should it be a canon or shouldn't it? But regardless of where you stand on the canonicity of the book, Enoch 1 is just an absolutely fascinating read if you either want to get like the director's cut of what was going on in Genesis 6, where these sons of God came into the daughters of men and gave birth to giants, and there were giants in the earth in that time, and then also afterwards, meaning after the flood. But it's also an interesting read if you want to put an ancient template over the ancient alien Anunnaki phenomenon that we're hearing about now a lot. And so there's this storyline where the Anunnaki are actually the ones that created man, and they came to Earth, and they are our progenitors. And if we seek after them and their knowledge, we can ascend and become higher vibrational beings, and we can get out of these flesh suits and become we can reach all of our potential. And so it's all just a repackaging over and over and over and over again of the same story that we're getting in the Book of Genesis. It's amazing to me, if all we had was the Book of Genesis, we would have almost every piece of information we needed to solve this puzzle. I think a lot of people overlook Genesis because they're like, oh, Adam and Eve in the garden, then there's a talking snake, and then they are bad, and then there's a flood. And it's all been relegated to like children's stories. It's stuff that you like learn in Sunday school, and Noah's Ark, you decorate your baby's nursery with it, and which I've always thought was a little weird, as a theme for a child's room. This is the time where God was so mad he flooded the whole earth, but that's where you put your baby. I just think that's funny. But anyway, there's so much esoteric stuff in Genesis. And if you read the Book of Jasher, which is the Book of Genesis repeated, but there's tons of blanks filled in, the Book of Jasher is just mouth-dropping, and it's very actually controversial to modern senses, because it talks about these divination cups that Joseph had, and when you read about the stuff that Moses and Joseph and these godly men who were chosen by God, chosen by the good guy, there was a lot of very supernatural stuff going on out in the open, even amongst the believers. And now we look at it like, all that stuff's a cult. And it's not that the power that's harnessed in and of itself is bad. It's who's harnessing it, why are you harnessing it, what are you using it for? But the way we've kind of been brought up to believe in this, Christian culture here in America, is anything that smacks at magic or supernatural or divination, it all belongs to the cult. And that everything astral and everything in the second and third heaven, everything is now evil, and you can't dabble with it. But But what I try to explore in my book and trying to come up with what are these sleep paralysis experiences that people are experiencing where they're traveling into the astral realm and they're, you know, against their will many times, the people who are experiencing sleep paralysis feel harassed and they're trying to find ways to get out of this, like to stop this. And it's just a continuation of what has been going on from day one, and that is this cosmic war between the second and third heaven, and we're caught like cannon fodder in the middle of it. And anyone watches the news for 30 minutes or less a day, I don't understand why that's a difficult concept to grasp. It is so clear that we are caught in some sort of a cosmic war.
So can you think about this as well? Because human beings, they like to think of themselves as the most intelligent species on the planet. And by looking at the way the planet's being run, you know that's not true. Which means that the planet's being run by somebody probably a bit smarter who has opposite agendas to what humans want.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, we might be intelligent, but we have a flaw. You know, it's kind of like in Star Wars, they build this huge space station, this, like, state-of-the-art Death Star, but there's that flaw they build into it for God only knows why. And if you shoot your little thing in there, the whole thing blows up. And so there's this flaw in the beauty and perfection of the highest intelligence of humanity, and that is we are so easily corruptible. Like, it does not take much to bribe or coerce people in power, especially. And so the people in power may have gotten there because of some sort of extreme education or extreme intelligence. You know, I mean, a lot of these people who are our enemies and who are out there doing all sorts of nefarious things that are not benefiting humanity, a lot of them are where they're at because they are very intelligent people. But unfortunately, the other side of the coin is they're very easily corruptible as well. And so when you've got someone that can turn on a dime, that can backstab, that can sell somebody out, that can be bribed for power or to save their own skin, you no longer have leadership that can ultimately protect us.
So let's think about this as well, because I was thinking about it this morning, like one guy I had on way back in the day, he was talking about cloning and how there's these clone rooms and how there's reptilian aliens down there and they can clone your consciousness or clone your body and transport your consciousness to the facility and then rape you and torture you and all of that kind of stuff. And now he was kind of like telling me that, you know, when you're looking at politicians who are making missteps or mispronouncements in speech or doing crazy things or something like that, it's not just these people are crazy and psychopathic and grown up with satanic ritual abuse and are doped out of their minds on psychotropic drugs in order to be able to do the horrible jobs they're doing. He's like saying, no, bro, it's because they're clones. Right, and I'm just kind of thinking it discounts a whole lot. So when we look at society and we look at how it's running and we look at how it's being run to a degree, what do you think we can discount and what do you think we really shouldn't count out in terms of all the crazy stuff that we hear? I think that, like, some of it must have validity because people aren't that creative. They can't make the stuff up.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that is really sort of at the crux of this whole red pill phenomena. You know, when people say that they get red pilled, like reference to the Matrix, it is this overwhelming sort of mind screw, right? And so one of the things that I think is probably happening there is they just blow as much subterfuge as they possibly can at us. And there's a point where I don't even know if they care if it's true or not, because if our minds get boggled and we start contemplating, this is the problem I had. Once you say, okay, I'm willing to believe this thing that's really crazy, then the next thing that's even crazier becomes a little bit easier to accept. And then pretty soon, your ability to discern goes away completely, because there's a point where if you believe crazy things that legitimately are true, what can happen then is they can throw in a whole bunch of crazy stuff to just troll us, like, because they just know we're going to believe it at this point, because we're going to believe anything. And so I think some of it is legit, and some of it I think they're just laughing their heads off, because some, I think that they're bored and they just want to throw these things out there to see how stupid we really are. And then you got people doing all these shows on some of this, like, you know, every single celebrity in Hollywood is, you know, dead. And, you know, and there's a point where, you know, I think they're just laughing. And it's like, oh, man, they're so stupid. They believe anything. And they're just kind of like coming up with ridiculous things just to confuse us, just to entertain themselves with. But what's scary about that is then they throw in the things that really are true, that are maybe the things that we really need to believe. And at that point, a lot of us become jaded, because a lot of us who kind of got red pilled, there was a point where we started to kind of fall for everything. And then there was a point where we had to kind of rein it in and go, okay, now this is getting to the point where I'm going to lose my sanity. You know, if the world is this crazy, I can't completely give into that. I'm going to lose my mind. I still have to live in this real world. And so I think there's a point where we all sort of kind of take a step back and say, like, I can't believe every single one of these really bizarre theories. But that's where they then get you, because now you're in this phase where now you're starting to question everything again. So that's then when they can put the things in that are true, and then you're going to write it off. If that makes sense. I just think some part of their tactic is just absolute disorientation. It's just a chaos where nobody knows up anymore.
Well, that was the original reason for the creation of the OSS, the precursor to the Central Intelligence Agency in the United States. Their job during World War II was, quote, to confuse the enemy. All right?
Mm.
And just as an example, they would hijack a mail train full of letters that bound for Berlin, you know, high command. They'd hijack it, open all those letters, read them, change little details and things like that, rewrite them, reseal them, and then put the train back on the tracks and then send them into Berlin. And so people didn't know where their troops were. They didn't know what the guy down the hall thought of them. And they had all those things in their head, and they were so confused. And this was building up right until the D-Day invasion. So with an enemy so confused, how could they ever possibly repel their invaders? And after World War II, when the OSS became the CIA, their job was still the same. Confuse the enemy. They just changed the enemy to us.
Yeah. Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better. There's so much subterfuge going on. And, you know, there's so many warnings about this. You know, to wrap it in biblical language, you know, the way we're raised in the church, it's the enemy is a prowling lion seeking someone to devour, and be sober-minded, be vigilant. And it is amazing to me, especially kind of in this peace, love, post-hippie culture here in America, where everything's about light and love, it is amazing to me how unpolitically correct the Bible is. As a writer, I can tell you that the metaphors and the analogies in scripture are very often militaristic. There's a lot of military metaphors in scripture about what our life is like, and what the Christian walk is like, and what being fodder in this cosmic war is like. And a lot of people, they don't want to see that, but it's very clear that the Bible in many ways was written like a military manual. This is how we survive on a battlefield. And a lot of the things that are taken as rules and laws and legalities and lack of freedom and lack of independence and all, you know, all these boundaries, it really is, let's look at it, maybe our sergeant major has a bird's eye view of this war and knows what areas we should stay out of, because that's where all the cannons are hidden, or that's where all the landmines are. And maybe all those rules and regulations aren't to ruin our fun, but to preserve us as a race and as a people. And, you know, we're all desirous of happiness and joy and relationship, and there are ways to seek and find and preserve what we really want most on planet Earth without all of these trails that take us off deep into the woods to just get killed, you know. And so I tend to look at the scripture not so much as this religious rule book, so much as there's like a cosmic, like, major general somewhere who has got the battle plans and is sharing those battle plans with us so that we can stay several steps ahead of the enemy.
Let's think about this as well, because if we're talking about the enemy, who is the enemy? Is the enemy ethereal, or is there actual literal creatures out there and stuff like that that are the enemies of humanity?
I personally think both. I think that there's a spiritual and a terrestrial war going on. There's things beyond the veil that we don't see and that we're not involved in. And we get hints of that in the book of Daniel. Daniel was in some trouble, and he prayed, and he waited 3 weeks before an angel came to him. And the angel, this is so crazy that this is in the Bible. The angel basically apologized and said, "Hey, dude, sorry it took me so long to get here. I was warring, you know, behind the veil with these, you know, demonic entities, and it took me 3 weeks to get here." So his mission was thwarted, but that was all behind the veil. Daniel didn't see any of that. He wasn't involved in it. He's just sitting there thinking, like, I prayed 3 weeks ago, and, like, I'm not getting any help over here. So I do think that there is a cosmic war going on behind the scenes. And it is ethereal, and you can talk about your soul and selling your soul to the devil in liminal spaces. And my book goes into a lot of that, because sleep paralysis and the astral realm, these are liminal spaces. These are doorways, portals. These are ways to traverse back and forth between the terrestrial and the spiritual planes, and to see behind that veil, which may or may not be a good idea, depending on who you ask. But I also think that there are literal, physical, tangible enemies here on Earth, both human as well as not.
Well, let's talk about sleep paralysis then. Your new book here is They Only Come Out at Night, Exposing the Dark Weapon of Sleep Paralysis. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wrote the book because I experienced this for over 40 years. And so it was something that took me, it literally took me 30 years to even figure out what it was, because this isn't something that was talked about widely back in the 70s. And I didn't even hear the phrase sleep paralysis until I was in my mid-30s. And I thought I was the only one going through this, and I didn't want to say a word about it to anybody. I told one friend one time when I was 15, and she came back to school on Monday and said, "You're demonically possessed, and my mom wants to take you to church, and a priest is going to exorcise demons out of you." And I was like, forget it. Yeah. And so obviously I learned then, like, you can't tell people about this. And so I just thought this was, I knew it was more than nightmares, but I really didn't know what it was. And it was frequent. I mean, it happened frequently from the time I was about 3 years old. And so when I found out that this is an actual phenomenon, and thousands of people have gone through this. It's been documented in medical history since the 17th century, but in spiritual and esoteric literature, it goes back even further than that. It's mentioned in the book of Job, which is one of the oldest books of the Bible. And so when I realized this is something that a lot of people are suffering from, and when I realized the extent of the trauma that some people who have this go through, there are people that I've talked to even recently since the publication of the book that they are so tormented by this that it's interfering with their lives. It's interfering with their work, their marriages. There's a couple people I've spoken to who are suicidal. There are people where there's levels of sleep paralysis. There's a spiritual type. There's also like an occult version. And then there's a militarized version of it. And you've got remote viewing, and then you've got human beings that have the ability to astral project into your room at night. And then you've got the actual sleep paralysis where you're interacting with these entities and many times going up into the astral realm against your will. And I know there's a lot of people that astral travel and it's intentional and they've studied to do it and they want to be there. But sleep paralysis is typically a group of people that are not seeking this out.
Mm. Well, I think astral traveling is going to experience a big boom since the COVID jams and stuff like that means that people can't travel physically anymore. So the question on my mind is really, I mean, what is it that's paralyzing you at night?
Well, that's a great question, because I think that that part can be very easily demystified. I think that these entities that are coming to us in the middle of the night are capitalizing on opportune timing and our ignorance of our own physiology, because there is a point in certain levels of sleep where we will be paralyzed. We phase in and out of this paralytic phase several times. Every time we drift in and out of sleep, there's brief moments where we're in altered states of consciousness on both ends of coming in and out of sleep. And when we're in deep levels of sleep and REM sleep, there is a natural type of paralysis that occurs, and it's for our own protection. It's so that we're not falling out of bed or sleepwalking into traffic or peeing the bed or kicking someone we're sleeping next to. We are in somewhat of a deeply relaxed state where we can't move. And a lot of people, myself included, will experience sleep paralysis with nothing nefarious going on. There's no hallucinations. There's nothing scary. You just kind of wake up and you're like, oh, I'm asleep and this feels so good. And you can't move, but it's not frightening because you understand lucidly that I'm coming out of sleep and this feels very peaceful. So I think that's where a lot of confusion comes in. I think that's where a lot of the gaslighting comes in, because there's so many people that have experienced the non-nefarious types of sleep paralysis. So when other people are talking about all of these shadow people and red glowing eyes in their bedroom, they're like, well, these people are nuts. I have this happen all the time. What are they talking about? And rightfully so. So I think that the actual paralyzation piece, there's nothing sort of demonic or bizarre about that. These entities are coming to us at a time when we're defenseless, we're confused, we're half asleep, and we can't move, and it just intensifies the experience. It makes it more horrifying. It's kind of like it's a bonus for them, like on top of appearing and becoming, you know, it's already a frightening experience if you're seeing these things. But if you have a sense of, I have no control in this situation, I'm trapped here, I can't move. And if you believe that you can't move because they are exhibiting some sort of power over you, you are going to have less of a chance of thinking or your way out of that situation. And so I think the actual paralyzation piece, there's nothing mystical about that at all, I don't think. What becomes mystical is, why are thousands of people seeing the same thing? If it's just a dream, how come everyone's having the same dream? How come they're seeing the same entities? And I know that there's psychological studies that write that off, you know, where, well, you've read about it so many times, like the alien grays. The reason why everybody says they're 3 feet tall and they have big black eyes is because it's been part of our cultural vernacular for so many decades now, that obviously that we're all going to start sharing that experience, whether we've actually seen it or not. So there's all these ways to that people that have these experiences are being gaslit and their experiences are being written off. But the fact is, and I don't know why people aren't more intrigued by this. Like, if I was a scientist or if I was some sort of a physician and, you know, I had an interest in neuroscience or I had an interest in the mind, if thousands of people were saying this phenomenon is happening to me during REM cycles of my sleep, I would be fascinated by that. Like, I don't know necessarily why, with all of the curiosity in this world, why everyone's just like, nope, it's a joke. Nope, that doesn't happen. I don't understand why people aren't more curious about it, because it is an extremely fascinating topic. Becoming even more fascinating if it's something that you've actually gone through, because you do observe things. And even though there's things that are very common to a lot of people's experiences, you'll hear a lot of the same things over again, like, I couldn't move, I couldn't breathe, there was an old hag on my chest, there was a shadow man by my door. You hear a lot of the same things over and over again. When you really start to delve into the research, you hear a lot of things that you've never heard before. And these just make the phenomenon, I find, even more fascinating. And with with the interest we have in the last two decades with the paranormal and all these ghost hunting shows and spirit boxes and all of these, you know, regression into past lives and astral projection, and the major boom of Gaia.com and all of these people studying this stuff, sleep paralysis is a natural component to that library of phenomenon. So I don't understand why that one is sort of still taboo. That's the thing, that the UFO abductions and the sleep paralysis, you know, you're not crazy if you astral project, you're not crazy if you talk to spirit guides, you know, in another dimension, you know, but for some reason, if this stuff happens against your will, then you're a nutball. So it's very interesting, the sort of taboos, even within the taboos topics of the paranormal.
Just kind of thinking about how the U.S. military had an idea to dress themselves up as aliens and then go around and use advanced technology to paralyze people and do experiments on them and things like that. And then when they come back, they think it was aliens and stuff like that. It was just like, no, those guys wearing alien suits. Very good ones. You know, and okay, sweet ass. Great. So now we've got an entire false phenomenon that's run by a secret bunch of people, and they're basically experimenting on the rest of us in such a way that anybody who hears about the experiments taking place would think that the person's crazy. And so you can get away with it perpetually.
Absolutely. It's brilliant what they're doing, because anything that is mystical or supernatural that we can then, through technology, reproduce, it's the perfect excuse then, like, oh, that's what's been happening the whole time. There was nothing mysterious about it at all. It's like when a magician gives away his tricks, you know? Mm. Oh, he's not sawing the woman in half. Oh, I get it now. But what you're saying is true. We've got Project Bluebeam. We've got Robert Monroe and the HemiSync technology, which he used within the U.S. Army back in the 80s to teach remote viewing. Every single thing that's happening in a sleep paralysis scenario or a UFO abduction scenario can now, through technology, be reproduced. In fact, they've located the exact part of the brain where they can stick a probe in and wiggle it. And when they do that, shadow people will appear to that patient. The patient Whoa. Will see shadow people. Yeah. So that can mean one of two things, depending on where you are in the line of belief. It can mean, okay, so there really is no such thing as shadow people, because that's what's been happening all the time. This person's brain, there's a malfunction, there's something pushing up against that thing in their brain. Or it could be the opposite. These entities might have a way to access areas of our brain where they're opening those portals so that we can see it. And we know from psychedelics, you know, there's many things that we can do with ayahuasca and mushrooms and you name it. There's things that we can do which affect the neural pathways in our brain and which can cause us to hallucinate. I mean, there's plenty of things that people do or see or visualize or hallucinate when they're high. And so it's kind of one of these, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Are they seeing that stuff because they're high? Or when you are high, are we accessing pathways in our brain that then show us things that are typically invisible to us when those pathways are closed?
Yeah. Are we seeing stuff that's really there that we ordinarily can't see, or are we just manufacturing it in our mind? And ultimately, I mean, look at what David Icke says about the visible light spectrum, is that light is huge. It's got so many different facets to light, and there's only a tiny little bit of the spectrum, the entire spectrum of light, that you can actually see. And so what could be hiding outside of the light that we can see? Anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What I try to tell people too about I really try to dissuade people from, you know, going up into the astral realm for entertainment, because there are a lot of nefarious things up there that you can, I mean, even practitioners will tell you, be careful up there. Every man for himself up there. There's lower vibrational beings up there who are no good. You got to stay away from them. So even the people that, know what they're talking about will say it's kind of a dangerous place to traverse if you don't know what you're doing. And so when you look at it, like I look at it like a diamond. So you've got like 52 facets on this diamond, and humanity, kind of like what you're saying with this light spectrum, if we're looking at one side of it, if we're looking at that diamond as a one-dimensional object, let's say we can see, you know, 15 of those facets, that makes us really intelligent because we can probably see 14 more facets than an ant, you know, or a pet dog. But if we had access to everything, full knowledge, and the pineal gland is open, and that the veil is torn between the physical and the spiritual, and we could see all 52 of those facets, if we could see it all. And that's what I think we're running into in the astral plane. We're running into entities that maybe they're smarter than us, maybe they do have a higher intelligence, or maybe they just have access to all 52 of those facets. They can spin that diamond and we can't. And so if you're dealing with someone that has got the full perspective and we don't, human beings are so easy to fool, even those of us that are intelligent. So when you go up to the astral plane and you come back, it's a sketchy remembrance. You're coming out of a dream state. And I'm always mystified by people who have either spiritual, like religious, spiritual or supernatural experiences, that they come back and, you know, within 24 hours, this is what happened, this is what it means, this is what I was taught, this is why they picked me. And it's like, how did you get all those answers so quickly? I mean, even when you look at it in scripture, Daniel had many visions, and Ezekiel and Jeremiah, and a lot of these, got John on the island of Patmos, who wrote Revelation. A lot of these prophets who wrote about the future, who had these visions, they went up into the third heaven, they saw the throne of God. They're, even in their writing, they're perplexed many times. They're like, I have no idea what that meant. What was that? And John even asks, as he's having the revelation visions, he would even ask the angel, like, what did that mean? And he'll say, don't write that down. That's not for anyone to know. Or, you know, I'm not going to tell you that. And so when I hear people who have had extremely mystical experiences in the astral that can come back totally calm, like, oh, it was awesome, and I learned this and I learned that, and my spirit guide told me this, and it's like, where is all of this assurance and confidence coming? We are exploring things completely unknown to us. And you know, in the biblical narrative, people that had these experiences, they came back disturbed. They were frightened. Daniel was sick for weeks after he had these visions. He was sick to his stomach, and he was disturbed by the things that he saw, and he was confused. And a lot of times, like with Daniel, he had to pray and fast in order to get an understanding of what he had just been shown. And so I think that in modernity now, we've got all these people having these mystical experiences, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of wonder or confusion or disorientation or fear attached to it. You know, and I'm speaking in generalities, of course, but it just doesn't seem to fit the narrative of people that have had these experiences that seem to be profoundly impacted by them. And so when someone just comes to me at work and goes, oh, I had this dream yesterday and it was so cool, like God came to me, and it's like, okay, wait, I already don't believe you. You're so cavalier about this. When you are in the presence of some sort of mystical being, and especially if you're in the presence of a higher life form, or in the case of God, you think that you've been in his throne room and you've been in the presence of absolute knowledge and holiness, and you just come back, you know, talking with the Valley Girl accent about this cool dream you had. I find it hard to believe that you were really in the presence of something mystical, magical, spiritual, or holy, because I think human beings are profoundly impacted when we run into otherworldly things. That's why sleep paralysis is so terrifying. Even if you can't see one of these entities in the room, people will say, I knew it was there, I felt it. Like they sense that something evil has come into their room, and everything in their body is telling them something's here, and I should, like, all the fire alarms are going off. This is frightening. We have the same sense when we have a good spiritual experience. And so the complete overconfidence and the lack of appropriate emotions that follow a lot of people's experiences lead me to believe that some of these things, like you're talking about with the government, they're being manufactured to fool us. They're being manufactured so we think we're having some sort of spiritual transformation or some sort of spiritual experience. But it's just being manufactured, because all of the life-changing, transformational, and emotional aspects that go along with an authentic experience, are missing in a lot of those testimonies.
How do you really define somebody as authentic? Because obviously there's no evidence. You've got no physical evidence. There's no ectoplasm or anything like that. It's just basically you have to take somebody at their word, don't you? But of course, you know, when you're doing investigation, corroborating other people's stories, it's actually quite simple process in journalism. Three people saying the exact same thing who haven't seen each other before and haven't heard each other's story before. That's it. That's how you know that they're telling the truth. And of course, as you've said, you know, you go around and you investigate this, and a lot of these commonalities and similarities start coming up. So they're not just saying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the interesting thing, too, about sleep paralysis, you know, is because it is still a taboo topic. And, you know, it's something that we can talk about online. It's something we can talk about on social media. But if you actually want to talk to someone who you know in the real world, like, I'm going to tell my family about this, or I'm going to tell my boyfriend about this, that's when you really know whether or not, you know, it's acceptable or not. Because a lot of the people that I'm talking to, they have a lot of forums online that they can go to where they've talked and they've met people that have had the same experiences. But when they, in their real world life, like tell a girlfriend or tell a parent, they're not received. You know, that's where the gaslighting or the, you know, the silence comes in. And, you know, the difference between something that's esoteric or occult, which just means hidden, is if we're thinking in terms of a cosmic war with good versus evil, okay, we got a red lightsaber and a blue lightsaber, okay? On the occultic side, they operate in secrecy, and that is where their success comes from. So there's things that are hidden that need to remain hidden. And being incognito is a necessary part of their game plan, because if they're found out, it ruins the battle plan. And what's very interesting to me, because it's so contrary to the way we as human beings think, is in scripture, when Jesus came to earth, you know, and he proclaimed himself to be God. He proclaimed to be, you know, basically not ultimately human before he came to earth. He said the opposite. Every single thing the Father has told me, I will share with you. I no longer call you servants, but friends. Mm-hmm. And everything that the Father has shared with me, I've shared with you. And so what's interesting to me about God is I would think, because he is in a position of power, that secrecy would be key to his success. And yet he doesn't hide these things. And it's not that we have them all figured out, but as far as the battle plan goes, he's got it written all the way out to Revelation, where he showed a guy, this is exactly what's going to happen. This is the battle. This is what the army is going to look like. This is who's going to come against you. This is how many days. Here's the calculations. What general, like during World War II, who's going to get on news and like explain their battle plans, you know, for the world to see? Everything is ciphered and encoded. And so another just interesting tell for me as a journalist and a researcher is anytime someone starts getting really scared that you have information or subjective knowledge or experience on something and they want to shut you down, and they want you to be quiet, or they don't want you on YouTube anymore, that really makes me wonder, are you on the side of the cosmic war where everything has to remain esoteric? Because I'm on the side of this war where I can tell you every single thing I think and feel, and my objective is not compromised. Because it doesn't matter if you know my battle plan, because it's already been written out before you. All I'm doing is telling you stuff that's been written down in black and white for thousands of years. And so I'm not giving away any secrets here. I'm not going to be in trouble with the big guy if I tell you something. So there's no fear in it. And so whenever there's a lot of fear in this, it just makes me wonder, okay, whose side in the cosmic war are you on? Because there really doesn't have to be a lot of fear. The more we figure out, you know, I thought knowledge was power. So shouldn't we be encouraging one another to connect all these dots and figure this out? And so for those who are thwarting the efforts, once we get dots connected, we get, you know, shut off YouTube. What's going on there? What are you afraid of?
Why is this such an important subject to people? I mean, you've been personally affected by sleep paralysis. I haven't. I've never even studied into it, really. I mean, I've heard of it in passing and things of that nature. What's it actually like?
It is very scary. And I sort of lucked out. Like, my experience doesn't get anywhere near as terrifying as a lot of people's. What made mine hard was it was very frequent. It was 3, 4, 5 nights in a row for 2, 3 weeks at a time, and then it would go away for a month or two, and then it would come back. And so it was very, very common. And what a lot of people who have sleep paralysis explain, and this is easily explained away by science too, but anyone who's had it will tell you, the taunting doesn't just happen during the episode. It begins before you fall asleep, and it continues once you wake up. And so a lot of us, you'll go to bed at night and you'll get this feeling, it's going to happen tonight. And you know. And so science explains this away. Well, now you've become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because now that that's embedded in your head, it's going to happen because you said it, and this and that and whatever. But many people will report that the torment actually kind of starts beforehand. And a lot of people with sleep paralysis become insomniacs, or they become night owls and they stay up really, really late because they're kind of putting off the inevitable. And sometimes people are like, well, 3 a.m. is the witching hour. So if I go to bed after 3 a.m., I'll be safe. And so then they're staying up till 3 a.m. on work nights, and then it's affecting their work and their life. And so it's not something that just happens during the night. And I think that's why a lot of people don't understand. The average sleep paralysis encounter lasts about 10 minutes. That's the average. They can be shorter and they can be much longer, but they last about 10 minutes. And so people think, well, like, what's the big deal? It's 10 minutes and you wake up and it's all over. But it's not. It's bookended by a lot before and after that a lot of people don't talk about. But a lot of people experience feelings of being choked or crushed. There's a lot of people that are explaining things that kind of go from the chin to the sternum here. And it has to do with breath. And I've done a lot of research on that because it's interesting to me. You've got several dots here. You've got a biblical narrative that talks about the creation of man, that man was just an inanimate lump of clay. And what made him human was God breathed his breath into him. So you've got this concept that life, or our soul in effect, is the breath of the creator. Then you've got sleep paralysis where they're attacking the breath. And then you've got, for the last 3 years, what I believe to be chaos magic. You've got a globe full of people wearing t-shirts and saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. You've got ventilators, mm-hmm. You've got CDC websites saying shortness of breath. You've got George Floyd's last words, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. It's this, it's a mantra, it's a sigil, it's creating chaos. Because the more you've got a planet full of millions of people all saying, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, there is an energy then that is being derived from that. And sleep paralysis, anyone who has had sleep paralysis their whole life could have told you way before 2020 that there's something about breath that just evokes hatred in these things, whatever they are, whoever they are. And so a lot of the sleep paralysis experiences involve choking and a crushing. And I have a whole chapter in my book about the similarities between these astral entities and these sleep paralysis entities and our modern folklore about vampires. And vampires, you know, again, the target is the neck. It's the trach. It's where the breath comes from. You know, and we get all hung up on like, oh, you're getting bit and he's drinking your blood. But it is a crushing of the neck. It is a stealing of the breath. It's a taking of the life force. And there's many other similarities between vampire lore and sleep paralysis as well. These many people who have sleep paralysis will talk about waking up and the first thing that they see is some sort of a shadow person or an entity or a black shadow or something with glowing red eyes. And more times than not, it's lurking at the bedroom door. Now, it can be other places. Sometimes it's under the bed, at the window, in a corner. But many of them will say the door. And that was my experience as well. It would always stand at the door. Mm. This is also very vampiric because we know from vampire lore that a vampire cannot touch you unless you invite it. You give it an invitation. Mm. And once it's given invitation, it steps over the threshold.
Mm.
And what I go into great detail in the book, it was very fascinating, is in antiquity, all throughout the world, it's kind of fallen out of our modern cultures, but all throughout antiquity, in almost every country in the world, they had threshold covenants. And it's the way that you, it was a form of hospitality. And when you invited someone into your house, when they crossed the threshold, there was a situation very similar to like our Passover story in the Bible, where they put the blood on the lentils at the door. This was done frequently. That Passover event wasn't a new thing. You would invite someone over, you would sacrifice an animal, you would split the pieces, you'd walk between the blood, and often you would dip your hands in the blood, you would shake the hands, or you put the handprints in the blood on the lintel. If you go even further back into antiquity, before civilized, you know, practices came into being, it went all the way back into like the dragon cults and the serpent cults. That was an actual exchange of your blood. And so it was even more vampiric. It was a drinking of blood ceremony. And then as we get more civilized, the blood kind of gets less and less and less. Whereas back then, once you provided that, you did that ceremony with someone, once they stepped over your threshold, they were forever a part of your family. The head of that whole household was swearing to protect that person they went into covenant with. You are safe. I'm giving you sanctuary in my home. I will treat you as a bloodborne son in my household. And so you would be in a covenant. And we see that imagery even in Christianity, and we see it in the Bible. And in Revelation, Jesus says, "Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door, I will come in and eat with him and he with me." This was a threshold covenant. I'm going to knock at the door. I'm not going to come in unless you invite me. But if you do invite me, if you give me invitation, I will step over that threshold. And then when we eat, which is a salt covenant, because they're eating bread together, and a salt covenant is a whole other promise of protection and fidelity. It basically, what that verse is saying isn't just the invite Jesus into your heart and he'll be your friend. What that's saying is, if you allow me over the threshold of this temple, you know, your body is now the temple. If you invite me over that threshold and I covenant with you, I will swear to protect you in this cosmic war. You will be as a bloodborn child to me. You will be part of my family. I will die for you, and which he ended up doing. It's all part of a blood covenant. It's all part of a threshold covenant. And the demonic world, the astral realm, the vampire lore, these entities that hate the breath, that want to choke the breath out, they know about these blood covenants. They know the threshold covenants. And again, they're banking on our ignorance of these ancient covenants. So when they come over our door and they enter in and then we're pulled to the astral or whatever, there are actual covenants being made many times with these entities. And there are a lot of people that have sleep paralysis experiences, and they get up and they've got good recall. I had sleep paralysis last night. This is what happened. This is what I saw. But unfortunately, and this is what I mean by the spiritual realm has more facets of the diamond than we do. And the similarity between sleep paralysis abductions and UFO abductions is there's missing time and there's an abduction going on. Now, when you're in bed at night, you could have 2, 3, 4 hours of missing time and you'd never know it because we go to bed and we wake up 6, 7, 8 hours later. We're not looking for missing time. We don't notice if it's missing. And a lot of us, how many of us wake up? What'd you dream last night? I don't know. I don't remember. It fades. It's like morning snow. It just, the sun comes up and it melts. And so what I think a lot of people who have sleep paralysis don't realize is there's a part of that experience that you do remember. But what if there's a whole part of it that you don't remember? Mm. And what if you're up in that astral realm after you've given this thing an invitation into your room and it's crossed the threshold? Now you're in the astral realm. You don't remember necessarily what happened. If there was a covenant being made, that covenant needs to be undone. It needs to be broken. And this is where I think Christianity is completely misunderstood, because it's become kind of a joke, you know, and it's been so synchronized with other religions and Mithraism and occult practices. And it's become something vastly different than it originally was. It was originally this covenanting. And this also goes back to the vampire lore, because there's only two ways to undo a covenant with a vampire. You die, you get out of it upon death. Similar, like, and this is covenant language. How do you get out of marriage? You know, till death do us part. So covenants are lifelong. They're broken by death. The only other way it can be broken, and this is just going straight occult fiction, vampire lore, is if you invite a vampire into your home, but then the ownership of that home changes hands, because it has to do with who is the leader or the head of that household. So if you're no longer the head of that household, that invitation has to be, they have to be re-invited, because you're no longer the one that's the head of that house. That is where this whole concept that has been sillified, meaning it's become silly, of inviting Jesus into your heart. What they're really saying there is, you were in a threshold covenant with one of these entities. You gave an invitation, but when you become a Christian, you die to self, which is what it says in Corinthians. The old person dies and you become a new creation. And the temple, which is our body, is now the temple of the Holy Spirit. If you are now inviting Jesus into your temple, he is now the new owner of that home. That can nullify these astral covenants. And so there's a lot more esoteric, ancient things going on behind the veil. And this is why I call it a cosmic war, because it's not just about picking a religion or going to a church or bringing a hot dish on Wednesday nights and teaching Sunday school. Like, that has nothing to do with what's going on here. When Jesus came to earth, he was not preaching Sunday school lessons. He was telling about a cosmic war. And he said, there's two kingdoms. He preached the gospel of the kingdoms. There's two kingdoms. And when my kingdom comes, which is what we talk about in the Lord's Prayer, we're supposed to pray every day, thy kingdom come, thy will be done. What does that mean? It means his kingdom hasn't come yet. Right now, the kingdom of this world belongs to the enemy, which is why we see the enemy winning so often, and why we see so much chaos, and why we see so much darkness. But when
it's probably also why my court case is taking longer than the second coming of Christ. But anyway,
yeah,
go.
Yeah.
Continue,
yeah,
please.
Yeah, absolutely. So when Jesus was on earth, he wasn't trying to get, you know, Jesus isn't a modern American. He wasn't just trying to get a million, like, subscribers on TikTok. Like, he wasn't just trying to get a whole bunch of people to follow him. He wasn't starting a cult, or he was literally saying, look, you guys, there's a cosmic war going on, and prospects don't look real good, but I'm going to come back and I'm going to clean up this mess. And so you got to be wearing the right color jersey when I come back, you know, for this to work out for you. And so if you, when Adam fell, he covenanted, he gave on behalf of all mankind, he gave the invitation for the cosmic entities from the astral to come and bleed into the terrestrial. He invited them over the threshold and they came into the terrestrial plane. And there's one way for us to get out of those covenants, and that is to nullify those covenants with a new covenant. And so It's just so many aspects to this, and sleep paralysis is such a huge piece in this, because there's a lot of us that would not sell our souls while we're wide awake. We would, you know, it doesn't matter what is being promised us, we'd be like, no way, are you kidding me? So they have to be devious, they have to be secretive. And so there's many of us that would never enter into any agreement like that in our right mind or in our waking mind. So what do? They come at us when we're at night, we're asleep, we're disoriented, we're confused. And when we wake up, we easily chalk every picture in our head off to, it was a dream. There's no sense of trying to determine whether or not those memories in our head are memories or just dreams. It's a perfect place to unwittingly snare us into these covenants without us ever even knowing that we've entered into them. And I think it's why a lot of professing believers have such a struggle when they try to live out this Christian walk. It's because they're still entangled with things that they don't have a memory of, or that they don't aren't taking seriously, or they're not aware of. And you know, we call it spiritual warfare in the church. And I don't want to frighten people. I don't want people to think, you know, oh my gosh, I'm in one of these covenants and that means I'm going to burn in hell. Like, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that these covenants can easily be undone, but we're not ever going to work to get them undone if we're not aware of them. And so I'm just hoping that we can start having some intellectually honest discussions with one another, and we can bring all sides in. Let's bring in people that have deep knowledge of the esoteric and the occult and the astral and the New Age, people who have deep knowledge of the scriptures and the Bible, people who have knowledge of science and medicine and neuroscience. Let's get everybody at the table and let's start connecting these dots. There's dots to be connected. And if we stop, you know, just fighting with each other and trying to just shut everybody down, I think that we could stumble upon some really fascinating things that would put us ahead of the game as a human race.
Yeah.
One can only hope. Now, we have a breaking story that's actually happening here in New Zealand. So we've done a little hour interview, and that was actually really quite an eye-opener to a large degree for me, because I'm kind of sitting here going, you know, this actually makes sense for in a lot of different ways, you know.
I just want to add something quickly before we go, if we are going.
Sure.
I've actually experienced sleep paralysis when I was about 18. I'm 33 now, and it happened for about a year. And it was after I visited a abandoned mental hospital that we have here in New Zealand, which has since been knocked down. And it was terrifying. I used to be pinned down in my bed. I couldn't breathe. I felt like I had like four fingers down my throat, and I couldn't speak, I couldn't move, and if I tried to make a noise, it would be like, just couldn't, no sound would come out. And that would happen for, like you said, about 10 minutes. And it also started happening to my boyfriend at the time, and I would hear him making these noises when I was asleep. And I knew it was happening to him. And it was terrifying because there was nothing that we could do about it. And at the time we were living with, well, that's what we thought. At the time we were living with his mother, who suffered from dementia, and she was actually, she actually went blind from dementia. And she said that one evening she felt something come into her room and grab her arm. Whereas I had never seen anything. I'd never seen any creatures, but I felt it. I knew that something was there. And it's still one of the most terrifying things that's ever happened to me. And Vinny doesn't even know about it. And to this day, I don't sleep on my back, because I figured out that if I slept on my back, that it would happen.
Yeah, that's also very common. I would say 95% of the times I would have sleep paralysis, I would wake up on my back. And not only do you wake up on your back, but you wake up on your back in a somewhat contorted position with the spine off the bed sometimes, and the neck back and the mouth open. It's a very suggestive position in many ways. And it does make you wonder, was there something going on there in the spiritual or in the physical that would have put me into that position upon waking?
Yeah, well, I kind of put it down to it being completely negative and that, you know, I was being haunted because I visited this mental hospital as a stupid kid thinking, you know, I'm going to go and try and see what's going on in this paranormal world because we knew it was, we heard stories that it was haunted. And so we went there as stupid kids many times, not just once, but it started happening after just the first time. And I went to work. I was working for the local council in Whanganui, and I went to work and told my boss about it because I couldn't sleep. Like you said, I would just stay awake because I was terrified that this was going to happen to me again. And so I would just stay awake. And so I was tired. I couldn't perform at work. And so I had to tell my boss what was happening. And luckily, she wasn't calling me crazy because she had worked at Lake Ellis. Her and her partner had actually worked there as prison guards, kind of nurse prison guards, and they knew that the stories were about the place that in the end they couldn't tell the staff apart from the patients in some cases, and they used to give patients at Lake Ellis electric shock therapy. So there was a lot of negative energy, a lot of negative trauma. And so she gave me a number of a lady who was called herself a spiritualist, and I went and saw her, and she asked me for a photo of myself, a photo of my house, my address, and she said that she sent energy through the photo and asked this entity to leave because it was absolutely terrifying. I was beside myself, and I'm so happy it doesn't happen anymore. And I asked this lady, I'm like, can I give you some money? Like, is there something that I can give you? And she wouldn't even take $20. But I gave it to her anyway. Because I was like, you changed my life. I used to drive home from work and there'd be like a dark cloud on my way home from work. Driving home, I knew it was going to happen that night. So, it's fascinating that you have a whole book about this and that other people have experienced it, because I kind of put it down to, oh, I was just being haunted. I shouldn't have gone to that, you know, that abandoned mental hospital. It was my fault. I'm glad it doesn't happen anymore. And I knew of other people, you know, that it had happened to, and I just thought that it was a scientific thing, like you said, like, because there are points in our REM sleep where we can't move, but you don't feel like there's something on your chest and something down your throat and like you can't breathe and you can't move and you can't talk. That is terrifying.
Yeah. You've described it perfectly, and it is a common experience for a lot of people. And you also explained it well, because that is another form of invitation and, you know, conjuring. And we go and like hang. I used to do that when I was a kid. I thought it was cool to hang around in graveyards, and you know, we're just kids. We're trying to, looking for an adventure. And we hear the local lore about, you know, what you're going to see if you go down there, and all the little games we play at slumber parties with the Bloody Mary and the mirror and all that. But these can be a form of invitation. Whether or not those actual things have any power in and of themselves, if the spirit realm is listening into those things and saying this person's willing, ready and willing, and that can also be a form of invitation.
Yeah. And it was. And so then I went and saw that lady, and she got it to go away, as you say. I mean, Jesus wasn't involved in there. Not that I know of. I don't know who this woman is. I went and saw her twice, never saw her again in my life. She could have used Jesus. She could have said in Jesus' name. But like earlier in my life, I grew up in a Christian family, so I did actually give my soul to Jesus when I was like 8 years old or something. You know, I said that whatever it was, to at a Christian camp or something like that. But it still happened to me.
Yeah. Yep. Absolutely. I think sometimes we hear things like, well, if you're a Christian, you can't be demon possessed. And if you're a Christian, they can't read your mind. And like, we have all of these like sayings and mantras that we say over and over and over again. And yet, it does not mean that if we are out conjuring things that we're not gonna get something.
Yeah.
There is no spiritual prophylactic, ladies and gentlemen. Everybody can get a spiritual STD. You know, and that's the real thing that I think about it. So Unfortunately, we do have to seem to have lost our guest, and I've been frustrated here trying to get back to our initial story here with the Counterspin Media thing. So we're going to have to let you go, Vicky, and people can go and look at her website, VickyJoyAnderson.com. VickyJoyAnderson.com. And that's where you can get they only come out at night.
Oh, she left.
Well, she's just lost her connection.
Okay.
All right. Thank you so much. Show's over. All right. Excellent. Cool. Now we're going to get back to Counterspin now. I'm going to see if we can get rid of this thing. I barely need to take a WikiLeak myself. You too. You first, babe. All right. Sweet as. There we are. We've got Counterspin back. Let's unmute them, eh?
Got that twice.
The charges.
The value of free
speech. I said, so add a couple more, it doesn't
New
work.
New Zealand has to ask himself, what is the value of free speech? It's your right to know, and we are literally standing here on behalf of the New Zealand people to know and understand the truth.
Actually, ask these journalists here, how much to silence free speech? What's 55 million first pay?
Oh, the difficulties of streaming on Odyssey. Does it rewind? It doesn't rewind at all. Sorry, guys. It looks like it's it for the moment. Live stream's cut out on the Calvin and Hannah thing just when we run back to it, isn't it? Isn't that unfortunate? All right. Well, I guess that's about enough time to close out the show with Vicky. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to stop the recording now, but we will still continue to be live for the audience. So you can check out these archives at vinnyeastwood.com. And we will see you again very shortly. And please, before you go, remember to go to vinnyeastwood.com and donate and to support the broadcast. So we've got DK calling us in now again on the wrong Skype account, so we'll see
then
you
some
soon,
more
guys.
After that.